just simply euthanizing them doesn't make any difference at all, in my opinion. So that's basically what I wanted to talk about, are all these different ways that different organizations and people around the world, even right here in the U.S., different ways that they help animals by doing different activities, direct action, open rescue, investigations, everything you can imagine. It's not hopeless. I know every week it sounds hopeless when I talk about these things, but it's not. And a big important aspect of that is just getting the word out there. And so that's what I strive to do. I know it's hard to listen to, but it's important. And my goal is basically just to educate the listeners out there. And that includes every single one of you. So I do hope you enjoy the show. I hope you learn something every week. You know, as hard as it is to hear all this stuff, it's hard for me to talk about it and learn about it. I can't tell you how many times I thought, I really don't want to talk about that this week. It's too rough, but it has to be talked about. So thank you for listening. Yeah, it's 6 o'clock, so Ecotopia is coming up next. As always, my name is Sarah. I'm your host every week. I hope you'll tune in next week, and we'll have another good program for you. Thanks again for listening. As always, be good humans.
This is FM 90.1, KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And you're listening to Ecotopia, a weekly program exploring ecosystems, environmental, economic, social, and technological. I'm Stephen Chudy.
And I'm Susan Chudy. Tonight's program will focus on things nuclear, and our opening theme was Nuclear Infected by Alice Cooper from Flush the Fashion. Our guest will be Arjan Makhijani, President of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research in Tacoma, Maryland. We'll talk with him about the potential and peril for nuclear electricity in coming years, as well as the continuing threat to the world because of nuclear weapons.
Ecotopia is made possible by member contributions and by Many Gifts Healing, helping people through life transitions with craniosacral and visceral therapies, acupressure, and support for birthing and end of life. You can contact Malama McNeil at 864-2134 or email manygiftssm@gmail.com. And we're brought to you by Serenity Homes, specializing in Fuqua manufactured homes built using sustainable building practices. They offer over 70 floor plans with assistance on all site development needs, from permits to the final inspection. More information is available on the web at www.serenityhomes.com or at their showroom located at 2490 Bruce Road. Serenity Homes can be reached by calling 566-9480. And we also want to remind you that the opinions voiced on Ecotopia do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. We'll be right back to talk about the invention of nuclear power after this.
Invention of Nuclear Power by Peter Adams from the Spiral Eyes album. This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and tonight we are discussing nuclear energy and nuclear war.
We begin with an eyewitness description from July 16, 1945. The scene is the Manhattan Project command bunker near Alamogordo, New Mexico, during the testing of the first atomic bomb. General Thomas Farrell reminisces, "In a brief instant in the remote New Mexico desert, the tremendous effort of the brains and brawn of all these people came suddenly and startlingly to the fullest fruition. Dr. Robert Oppenheimer, on whom had rested a very heavy burden, grew tenser as the last seconds ticked off. He scarce breathed. He held on to a post to steady himself. For the last few seconds, he stared directly ahead, and then when the announcer shouted, 'Now,' and there came this tremendous burst of light, followed shortly thereafter by the deep, growling roar of the explosion, his face relaxed into an expression of tremendous relief. Several of the observers standing back of the shelter to watch the lighting effects were knocked flat by the blast."
General Farrell's account continues, "The tension in the room let up, and all started congratulating each other. Everyone sensed, this is it. No matter what might happen, now all we knew that the impossible scientific job had been done. Atomic fission would no longer be hidden in the cloisters of the theoretical physicist's dreams. It was almost full grown at birth. It was a great new force to be used for good or for evil. There was a feeling in that shelter that those concerned with its nativity should dedicate their lives to the mission that it would always be used for good and never for evil."
A Harvard professor threw his arms around Dr. Oppenheimer and embraced him with shouts of glee. Others were equally enthusiastic. All the pent-up emotions were released in those few minutes, and all seemed to sense immediately that the explosion had far exceeded the most optimistic expectations and wildest hopes of the scientists. All seemed to feel that they had been present at the birth of a new age, the age of atomic energy, and felt their profound responsibility to help in guiding into right channels the tremendous forces which had been unleashed for the first time in history. General Farrell's account appears in the Department of State Foreign Relations for the United States Conference of Berlin, Potsdam, 1945, and it's accessible at eyewitnesshistory.com.
But would the power of the atom always be used for good and never for evil? In the 60-plus years since the testing of the A-bomb, General Farrell's optimism seems naive at best. The following is from an interview conducted last Friday, March 6th, by the National Journal Online. The interview was entitled Entering a Nuclear Energy Crossroads, and the interview was with Dale Klein, chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, appointed by President Bush in July of 2006, after serving as assistant to the Secretary of Defense for Nuclear, Chemical, and Biological Defense Programs. The journal asks, a recent International Atomic Energy Agency report said that Iran has enough nuclear fuel to build a bomb. The report explicitly connects having nuclear fuel with the ability to build a bomb, even though Iran hasn't signaled that's what it's going to do with the fuel. How do you react to reports like this? Dale Klein's reply suggests the complexity of nuclear issues today, including the fact that the science has become inextricably bound up with politics. Klein said, in terms of the uranium program, that is one that is a very difficult situation. If you look at a country's nuclear ambitions, very few countries would start off with needing the fuel enrichment capabilities that Iran is doing. They don't have operating commercial reactors now, and there is a surplus availability of fuel on the world market. So from a technical standpoint, it doesn't make sense that Iran is going so robustly with an enrichment program based on their current demand for fuel. Russia has indicated it would sell it. France has indicated it would sell them fuel. That has been a difficult position technically. Iran has also not been forthcoming with the International Atomic Energy Agency with their inspections. All of those raise questions as to what is really the Iranian intent. That makes it a very difficult problem, not only for the United States, but for our allies, and what should we do and what can we do? I think that story is yet to be told.
And from Maneater, the newspaper of the University of Missouri, comes this report, also dated last Friday, describing recent legislation in Missouri which has opened up the possibility that a new nuclear energy reactor might be built near an existing reactor in Callaway County. Greg Young writes, with the passage of the Missouri Clean and Renewable Energy Construction Act, and I editorialized to note the name of that bill, the Missouri Clean and Renewable Energy Construction Act. With the passage of that on Tuesday in a House committee, an old debate in Missouri between the benefits and drawbacks of nuclear energy has resurfaced. The bill, which would repeal 1976 legislation prohibiting utility companies from raising rates on consumers while plants are under construction, has not only drawn ire about whether it has sufficient consumer protections, but also whether investment in nuclear energy is beneficial to the state of Missouri. Opponents of the bill and of nuclear energy generally point out notable problems with nuclear energy in terms of storage of the radioactive nuclear material. Missouri Votes Conservation believes nuclear energy is dirty and will distract utility companies from pursuing clean energy and efficient use of electrical power. Missouri Coalition for the Environment spokeswoman Erin Noble said, nuclear is not clean, nor is it renewable, given that uranium is not an infinite resource. However, Warren Wood, a spokesman for the Missouri Energy Development Association, said public support for building of more nuclear energy capability has increased. He said, if you look back 20 to 30 years ago, if you polled the population, you would find that it was very much a divided issue. But now, with the polling, you can get up there close to 80% of people are in favor of building a nuclear power plant. The source of Warren Wood's poll was not revealed in this particular article. Another issue related to the controversy has been the transportation of nuclear waste across the state of Missouri. Senator Kurt Schaefer, a Republican from Colombia, has sponsored a bill to add fees to trucks that drive nuclear waste through Colombia, and it passed the Missouri Senate unanimously 2 weeks ago. But despite these concerns, Schaefer said further investment in nuclear energy should be considered. Quote, "It is certainly a clean emission, and I think we do need to look at nuclear, and we do need to incorporate it." Recent ballot initiatives in Missouri have avoided concerns about nuclear energy altogether. Proposition C, which passed last November by a considerable margin, does not include nuclear power in the language, but the bill states that by 2021, investor-owned utilities in Missouri must have 15% of energy generated from renewable resources.
A bit perplexed by the claims and counterclaims, so are we. And we'll seek some clarification from Arjun Makijani right after this.
That was New Frontier from the album Nightfly by Donald Fagen. On the line tonight we have Arjun Makijani, who is president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research in Tacoma Park, Maryland. He has a wide range of interests, including both nuclear weapons and the nuclear energy and waste disposal problem. Good evening, Arjun. Thank you for being with us. Hang on, folks. We'll try this again and be with you in a moment. I hear you're mad about Ruben. Like your eyes, I like him too. He's an artist, a pioneer. We've got to have some music on the new frontier. Try again. Welcome, Arjun Makijani.
Hello.
Thank you.
Okay, we're trying one more time. Can you hear us now? Can you hear us now? Can you hear us now? I'm sorry, people. We're having a little trouble with the phone. We're going to try on a different line. Now I can hear us.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, brilliant.
Can you hear me? I can hear you all
yes,
the time.
Yes, and you're going out
you
over
cannot
the
hear me.
Yes, okay. You can hear me, but I couldn't hear you.
Yes,
okay.
I could hear you quite well.
Okay, well, I'm so sorry that that happened. We are now on the air. I can hear you going out, and I can hear us going out, so all is well.
So again, our guest tonight is Arjun Makhijani. Welcome at last. He's president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Could you begin, please, by telling us a little bit about the institute? What do you do there and what are your major concerns?
We're a nonprofit institute, and as our name says, we look at energy and environmental issues on a pretty broad front. I've worried a lot about nuclear energy and nuclear waste and proliferation problems, nuclear bombs, security issues with nuclear materials. I've also looked more at the positive side of things. How can we have a renewable energy system? And 2 years ago, I wrote a book, or a year and a half ago, I wrote a book called Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. So I like to propose solutions along with analyzing problems.
Excellent. We want to get to some of those solutions as we move on a little bit. We did want to ask you about the role of nuclear as it's perceived by the current political power. Both presidential candidates talked of nuclear power as part of a so-called sustainable energy mix. Candidate McCain talked about the fact we need lots of nuclear plants, 45, I think was his magic number. And President Obama still sees nuclear as part of the package, along with so-called clean coal, solar, wind, geothermal. What do you see as the emerging reality here? What's likely to happen?
Well, you know, I thought that President Obama and Senator McCain's positions were quite different during the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Senator McCain, as you noted, was very enthusiastic for new nuclear power plants. He wanted 45 to be built, or a certain number, and then after that, I think he wanted even more to be built, you know, going on to 100 or something like that. President Obama was more nuanced. He said, you know, the existing nuclear power plants play a vital role in preventing more carbon dioxide emissions,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's quite right. But for new nuclear power plants, he said that we should not build them until we have addressed waste, safety, and proliferation concerns. Given that those three concerns are very central to the essence of how nuclear power actually works, it creates these waste, safety, and proliferation concerns by its very nature, I don't think that President Obama actually supported new nuclear power plants. He didn't want to be labeled anti-nuclear, and he staked out a position that I thought was pretty sensible, and he seems to be sticking to it.
So how dangerous are nuclear power plants?
Well, they're not dangerous in the same way as coal is dangerous. Their routine dangers are not as serious as the dangers of fossil fuels in some ways, because for instance, the emissions from coal, the mountaintop removal, the pollution of the streams, the deaths of the miners. You know, there's a lot more problems on a routine level with coal, acid rain. It's not that there aren't problems with nuclear. There have been problems with uranium miners getting lung cancer, for instance, especially Native American miners in the 50s. Whose lung cancer rates were much higher than the rest of the population, and so on. The main problems with nuclear relate to some simple facts about how the energy system works. For instance, it creates plutonium as the reactor operates, and plutonium can be used to make bombs. The skills that are needed to build nuclear reactors and run them are pretty much the same skills that are needed to make nuclear bombs. So by the very fact of creating nuclear energy, we are both creating and perpetuating the skills and the materials needed to make nuclear bombs. So it's inherently proliferation prone. And then it's also very, very expensive. And so, in a way, you've got some very serious headaches with nuclear energy that would be better to avoid if we could avoid them.
Mm-hmm. What kind of combined package do you see emerging in the future? Through solar, wind, geothermal, can they be competitive as opposed to nuclear power proliferation?
Nuclear power is actually quite expensive. Mm-hmm. Existing power plants have been depreciated, but the main cost of the nuclear reactor and power plant is the capital cost. It's the cost to build it, build a reactor, install it, set up the controls, and so on. When you take all that into account, nuclear energy, new nuclear power plants will probably cost 10, 15, 20 cents a kilowatt hour to generate electricity. Wind energy today is at the lower end of that range. So wind energy generally already cheaper than nuclear.
Mm-hmm.
Concentrating solar thermal power plants where you heat up water or an oil and boil water and generate electricity, just like with a coal-fired or nuclear-fired power plant, those power plants are already competitive with nuclear, and their costs are going down while nuclear costs are going up. So I think nuclear power plants are actually economic lemons. The industry, you know, Wall Street finds them so risky that they don't want to fund them. Otherwise, industry would not be waiting in Washington, hat in hand in Washington, mm-hmm. for very large loan guarantees, because they cannot get the financing. Even before the present crisis, they could not get the financing to build new nuclear power plants.
And you assume that the buyout package will make that even more difficult for them?
Well, now, of course, everything is much more risky. So especially a project like nuclear power that requires you to see out 10 years and 8 years. So you have to make the investment today and predict the electricity demand 10 years from now. Well, mm-hmm. that's difficult in the best of circumstances. But today, given the turbulence in the global economy, it's essentially impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're building new energy sources that are going to be more expensive than the present one. So it's much better to build energy sources that will be modular and that can be built in a short time.
Mm-hmm.
A wind power plant can be completed in 18 months. And if you put solar cells, say, on a warehouse rooftop, that project can be done in 6 months. So it's much easier to foresee whether you're going to need the power or not 6 months from now than it is 6 and 8 years from now.
Mm-hmm. Is it conceivable then that capitalism itself could be the death of the growth of the nuclear power industry?
Well, capitalism already was the death of
yes.
the nuclear
mm-hmm.
power industry.
Right.
You know, in the late 70s and early 80s, when the interest rates went up and nuclear power plants became very expensive, people who were building them started canceling them.
Mm-hmm.
More than 100 nuclear power plants were canceled. There were bond defaults. Ratepayers suffered. Bondholders suffered. And that's how Wall Street turned sour on nuclear power. It wasn't an ideological thing. They just lost a lot of money. And so in the open market, nuclear power was actually pretty much dead and buried. And it is still dead and buried in the open market. The nuclear power companies will not build new nuclear power plants without either federal loan guarantees or advance payments from electricity consumers.
Mm-hmm.
So in Florida, for instance, the utility commission has authorized $400 million in advance payments from electricity consumers to the utility so they can start building a nuclear power plant.
Mm-hmm.
And the utility doesn't even promise to ever complete it and deliver the electricity. It's like paying somebody to build a house without their promising to ever complete it or give you the keys. So it's only by these shenanigans getting into the ratepayer pocketbooks and taxpayer pocketbooks that nuclear power plants can even be started. They can't mm-hmm. be started in the open market.
We earlier read a news story out of Columbia, Missouri, that the Columbia legislature also has removed a restriction that prohibits the utilities from charging customers for plants that are in the process of production.
That's right. It's essentially the governments are now levying taxes. This is like a tax, the government using its power to get into your pocketbook and then transferring the money to the utility, except it isn't called a tax, but it is essentially a tax. And then in some places, they don't even levy the tax equally on all consumers. Mm-hmm. Industries are exempt and big users are exempt. So it's the small guy that winds up paying for these large power plants that are likely going to be very expensive and not needed.
Can we credit activists for having added to the cost of nuclear plants? One of the concerns, I understand, is that of the utility companies, that there's so much litigation involved that too puts off building and makes it very costly.
This is really not a factually based complaint. It's just whining and propaganda. Because, you know, you can stick somebody else with a bad name and blame them for your own problems. The nuclear industry miscalculated how many power plants would be needed, and they also miscalculated the requirements of safety and so on when the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was rather lax early on, and actually the Atomic Energy Commission covered up many safety issues. And when they came to light and when they had to acknowledge that there were certain safety issues, then they had to go back and order these power plants to backfit.
Mm-hmm.
So construction cost increased not because of anti-nuclear activism, but because safety requirements demanded it, and also interest rates went up. And so the financial and regulatory circumstances that prevailed quite apart from anti-nuclear activists were the main cause of increasing. Not a single nuclear power plant has been canceled because of anti-nuclear intervention in the legal arena, to my knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Not one.
Okay.
So this is kind of actually shows how insensitive the regulatory system is to activism and intervener complaints.
We were trying to put a slightly more positive spin on that to say that maybe activism did make a difference, but your points are well taken.
Well, activism made a difference in the sense that I think activism actually has made nuclear power safer than it would otherwise be, because activists have raised lots of safety issues, and by bringing these safety issues to light, they have caused the power plants that we have to be safer than they would otherwise be. But I'm not aware that activism has helped stop. But what I object to is companies saying that it's the legal intervention that has stopped.
Right.
So bad publicity has stopped, excessive costs has stopped, and in that context, activists have been very helpful. I myself have been in the middle of canceling 8 nuclear power plants, but I did it as a consultant to the Tennessee Valley Authority. I advised them that they were building too many and they should cancel 8 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the chairman actually agreed with me and wound up doing it. So it's not that some of us haven't been involved in helping get nuclear power plants canceled, but it turns out that they weren't even needed.
That's a very useful clarification. We need to take just a short break. We're talking with Arjun Makhijani, president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. We'll be back to raise questions about the bomb right after this.
Just one.
was Gillian performing Mutually Assured Destruction, and we're talking with Arjan Makajani, president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research.
The other night we watched one of our favorite films, Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove with Peter Sellers. We were reminded once again that 60-plus years into the nuclear age, the threat of mutual destruction is still high.
The doomsday clock of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientist is set at 5 minutes to midnight, not as close as it once was, but still frighteningly close at hand. So how close are we to nuclear war?
Well, there are two or three different kinds of dangers now. They're a little bit different than during the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
There's the U.S.-Russian risk of nuclear war today that mainly relates to accidents and misunderstandings.
Mm-hmm. Like the submarines that bumped into each other.
That's right. And or a missed signal. The Russians in 1995 thought, for instance, that a weather rocket was a missile headed toward Moscow, and they put their forces on alert. Fortunately, they did not order their missiles to be fired off toward the United States. They decided to wait. Now, that was a miscommunication between the United States and Russia that led to that. There have been other incidents like that. Now, Russia and the United States keep weapons on high alert that can be fired off within 15 minutes, so the time to sort out misunderstandings is not very great.
Right.
So that is one pretty serious risk.
Mm-hmm.
The other kind of problem is a regional problem, whether it is the U.S. being allied with South Korea, confronting North Korea, or India and Pakistan, for instance, confronting
mm-hmm.
each other over the Kashmir problem. And the last kind of problem is the nuclear terrorism problem, where there might be nuclear materials on the black market, and people might learn to make nuclear weapons from, you know, openly available literature, and, you know, have a truck nuclear bomb or something like that.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think the possibilities of that are?
Well, nobody knows how to calculate the probabilities in any quantitative sense.
Sure.
But I think there are far too many nuclear weapons usable materials that could be diverted or put on the black market. There is something of a black market in nuclear materials. People are being caught. Fortunately, to the best of our knowledge, only small quantities of materials have been stolen. But the best thing to do with nuclear weapons usable materials, A, is to not make more, and secondly is to have the countries that have them declare all the stocks and put them under international verification and supervision, because that's really the most sure way initially to stop the threat of diversion so terrorists don't get hold of them. So we have three very distinct kind of dangers. You know, people say, well, we have to make sure that nuclear weapons don't fall into the wrong hands.
Mm-hmm.
And my position is that no hands are the correct hands. They
mm-hmm.
just represent different
sure.
kinds of dangers.
So what do you suggest, or what do you recommend, or what are the possibilities of having this kind of oversight and openness about who has nuclear weapons and where things are in the world?
Well, I think the U.S. and Russia are now embarked on a very hopeful dialogue. I think President Obama is a great leader. He's following his campaign promises to negotiate with the Russians and reduce nuclear arsenals, and setting the conditions that are quite positive for those negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
Within that context, I think addressing other problems will become less difficult. For instance, persuading Iran to not pursue the path of nuclear weapons, although they don't admit that they are mm-hmm. pursuing the path of nuclear
yeah.
weapons. They do appear to be getting the capability to do so. And then bringing the other nuclear weapon states to the negotiating table. It's very, very important to have a Middle East that is free of nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
So if we want Iran to not have nuclear weapons, somehow we have to find a path for Israel to
right.
not have nuclear
mm-hmm.
weapons. And Israel is a nuclear weapon state.
Right.
I think President Obama is also attending to the problem of Pakistan, I think, which in some ways currently is the most difficult situation, mm-hmm. because Pakistan has become more unstable in the last 10 years, and that's hard. Nobody sees a very clear, sure way to solving that problem. Now, the Indians and the Iranians may be part of the key to that, but one doesn't know.
Right.
Part of the the Russian strategy would be Russia, if the U.S. backs off on its plans to put missiles in Poland and the Czech Republic, then Russia might be persuaded to be persuasive with Iran in terms of discouraging it from further nuclear development?
Well, that's the hope. You know, that's obviously been broached with the Russians, but how much leverage the Russians and Americans can have over Iran? You know, Iran fought a war with Iraq, and the United States sided with Iraq. Mm-hmm. Iraq used chemical weapons against Iran, and you have to see and understand the context, that context, as the one in which the Iranians decided to acquire uranium enrichment capability. Now, so you have to remove, I think we have to start removing the underlying conditions that are giving rise to ambitions of countries to have nuclear weapons. Or you take North Korea. North Korea was essentially, you know, in the protective orbit of the Soviets and the Chinese until 1985, when Gorbachev came along, and suddenly they started feeling very vulnerable because the Soviets were making nice with the West. And that was the period in which they started having their own thoughts of having their own plutonium. And when the United States removed 700 nuclear weapons from South Korea that were aimed at North Korea, the North Koreans came to the negotiating table and sat down. So it's been back and forth with the North Koreans, depending very much in reaction to whether they feel threatened. Now, this is independent of their regime. They've got a terrible dictatorship over there that doesn't care about its people, but it doesn't mean that they're irrational to issues relating to their own survival and power, because they don't appear to be.
What about Israel?
Well, you know, the Israel question, I think, is in some ways the most difficult. Mm-hmm. They have never admitted that they have nuclear weapons, but they have a pretty sizable arsenal. That I think, is certain. They're the only country in the Middle East to have nuclear weapons. I think the question of Israeli nuclear weapons is really tied up, like so many questions in the Middle East, with the resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian question. And that is also connected to the relationship of Israel to the rest of the Arab world. So until that can be settled, I think, but that, you know,
right,
is very difficult. There are many people now who are not seeing how a two-state solution can emerge from this, and mm-hmm. I certainly am not expert enough to give you a good read on it.
Right, but every news report we hear makes it sound extremely complex, and with both sides kind of unable to resolve that very issue, the two-state solution.
President Carter has written quite well on mm-hmm. this topic, and, you know, it takes a lot of political courage to be able to talk to both sides. I don't, you know, I think President Obama has initiated a bold diplomacy, but when it comes to Israel, the domestic discourse in the United States is so constrained, and everybody is so afraid that, you know, they're going to be criticized. For being anti-Israel, especially in the political arena, that I think that to my understanding, the discourse on Israel and Palestine is more constrained in the United States than it appears to be in Israel.
Interesting.
Could we shift gears just a little bit? Here in Chico, we're part of a national movement called Beyond War, A New Economy is Possible. It's been generated by United for Peace and Justice. and it's interested in demilitarizing the budget. We suspect you share that general interest.
Yes.
What sorts of savings could we do if we had better control over nuclear issues and implementation?
Well, you know, we spend about $30 or $40 billion on nuclear weapons every year. Off that, about $6 billion is spent in looking after nuclear materials and cleaning up the contaminated sites. So most of that budget could be eliminated. We also have, as President Obama has said, lots and lots of Cold War-oriented systems.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We've got a United Nations that has become non-functional, that we desperately, to a large extent, you know, in security terms, right, because it is not empowered by the five nuclear weapon states. Basically,
yes,
you've got five nuclear weapon states who are the most powerful, who are not obeying their obligations for nuclear disarmament, who are telling everybody else what to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a very healthy way to run an international system. It's not reflective of how the current international order should look like. And so I think demilitarization in the United States is going to be much more difficult than some of us would like to think, because it's not a simple matter of, well, if we reduce the spending here, we'll have $100 billion more to build schools,
right,
which would be very desirable, but it's actually not possible to make that transfer of funds that easily. It's very, very difficult, because every time you suggest it, there's some kind of militarist idea that steps into the national arena and, you know, says, well, here are all these threats, and here are all these threats, and here are all these threats, and here are the things that we have to do, and we have to maintain a perpetual state of alert or war, and so on. And then, of course, there's the whole question of war for oil. You know, even Alan Greenspan said that war in Iraq is for oil. So until we start stepping back and doing renewable energy sources and not feeling the need to control other people's resources, I think it'll be hard to reduce the military budget.
Do you think that the economic crisis could motivate that discussion a little bit more?
Well, I think, you know, President Obama clearly talked about it in his address to the joint session of Congress, but there are some indications of that in his budget, but it doesn't look very hopeful on Capitol Hill that the military-industrial complex is going to be significantly disciplined to reduce the budget significantly, because in an economic crisis, Congress people don't want to be advocating shutting down military industries and creating more joblessness. The reality is that a lot of our jobs are tied to terrible and difficult things that we would rather be better off without, but now that the jobs are there and making these devices and making bombs and making ships and that we don't need, then the question is, how do you actually take that same infrastructure and do something else with it? It's a non-trivial problem.
Mm-hmm. Right. I understand.
As we move toward closing, I'd like to jump back to the whole question of activism and more specifically the role of informed citizens in a democracy. Your institute publishes a newsletter called Science and Democracy.
Yes, Science for Democratic Action.
For Democratic Action. Sorry, I got that wrong. In general, though, Americans are often seen as scientifically illiterate, or we waive decisions, say, well, smarter people than I can make those decisions. Do you think Americans can be technologically and scientifically literate? Are we smart enough? Can we know enough about these issues to make intelligent decisions?
Well, I think Americans are as smart as anybody else. I think if everybody has to make the effort, we all have the brains. In my experience, we conduct technical training workshops for people who had given up on math decades ago, and they come, and they're motivated, and in a week they go away mathematically literate. So this is
not doing
calculus at the end of a week, but they can read the technical documents that concern them and their neighborhoods. That's our goal. So, you know, you can actually take a math lesson free on our website.
You can go
up to IEER.org. There's a classroom section, and you can learn how to read technical documents and go through some of the problem sets in our classroom. And democratization of science is absolutely critical to the function of a democracy, because only then will we feel a little bit empowered to understand the decisions that are being made on our behalf. It's okay to say scientists should do scientific research, but ultimately a democratic political process has to make the decisions about what research will be done, and secondly, what fruits of the research are worthwhile pursuing and what may be not so helpful to society.
Yes, I think we've been lax in trying to anticipate the unanticipated consequences. That's not always easy to do, but the nuclear waste disposal issue was clearly ignored 30 to 40 years ago.
Yes, and scientists thought it would be rather easy to solve, and they were wrong. It's turned out to be very difficult to solve.
We want to thank you, Arjun Makajani, for being with us tonight. He is the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. The website is www.ieer.org, and it's a very rich site with all sorts of connections. Thank you very much, sir, for being with us.
And you can download my book free from our website.
Ah, okay.
Oh, excellent.
Good.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye.
Come, you masters of war. Here that build the big guns. Here that build the death planes. Here that build all the bombs. Here that hide behind walls. Here that hide behind disks. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes. And I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten all the triggers for the others to fire. And then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. You've thrown the worst fear.
That's Bob Dylan singing Masters of War from the Freewheelin' Bob Dylan album. This is Ecotopia on KZFR. And we've been talking tonight about nuclear energy and nuclear war. We want to remind you that coming up at 7 o'clock tonight is The Storyteller. Are you ready for a trip around the world? Tune in to The Storyteller and journey to places near and far. Listen to stories from your anthropological guide, Adrian Scott. And at 7:30 on KZFR, All Mixed Up with Mark, Mike, and Jeff, bringing you a 2.5-hour program of rock and pop from the edges of mainstream and contemporary music. We also want to remind you that Ecotopia is made possible by member contributions and by Green Ovations. Based in Chico, Green Ovations specializes in energy-focused retrofitting and green building upgrades. They offer in-home energy audits, diagnostic testing, and environmentally friendly products for home improvements. Green Ovations can be reached by calling 895-9700 and on the web at green-o-vations.com. And we're brought to you by Serenity Homes, specializing in Fuqua manufactured homes built using sustainable building practices. They offer over 70 floor plans with assistance on all on-site development needs, from permits to the final inspection. More information is available on the web at www.serenityhomes.com or at their showroom located at 2490 Bruce Road. Serenity Homes can be reached by calling 566-9480.
And we want to thank Halima Collingwood of the Mainstream Media Project for putting us in touch with Arjun Makajani. The project also has prepared some excellent materials for people who would like to learn more about nuclear issues. We've posted a number of these on our website, including the Project for Nuclear Awareness, which seeks to end a global threat of nuclear weapons by educating the public and lawmakers.
Plowshares Fund, a public grant-making foundation that pools contributions from individuals, families, and foundations and spends the money in ways to prevent the spread and use of nuclear weapons.
And the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. It's in Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization dedicated to enhancing international peace and justice and security.
The New America Foundation has a geopolitics of energy project that focuses on structural shifts in global energy markets, having important political and economic implications that are not usually described.
The Council for a Livable World, another Washington-based nonprofit, is dedicated to reducing the danger of nuclear weapons and increasing national security.
We also mentioned earlier a new Chico initiative called Beyond War, A New Economy is Possible. By way of full disclosure, we want you to know that both Susan and I are part of this project, and we would like to alert you to a community forum that will be held a week from Wednesday. This will be March 18th, 6 to 8:30 p.m. at Cafe Culture, 5th Street at the railroad tracks. This forum will focus on the military budget, including the costs of preparation for and prevention of nuclear war, and community members will be invited to itemize their concerns in the current economy and how best to redirect the budget for a peacetime economy. There's more information at www.chico-peace.org.
That's it for Ecotopia tonight. Next week on Ecotopia, we'll do our quarterly program observing the change of seasons. We'll celebrate the spring equinox and explore the poetry, prose, lambs and lions, expectations and disappointments that we recognize when spring has sprung. Thank you for listening to Ecotopia. I'm Susan Chudy.
And I'm Stephen Chudy. Thank you very much.